All right. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Tom Wallace, and I would like to welcome everyone to the Hospital Outpatient Prospective Payment Reimbursement Methodology Public Meeting. I will be facilitating this meeting this afternoon. This is our fourth and final public meeting around the Hospital Outpatient Prospective Payment System. Hopefully most of you who are on this call have been listening in to the other ones we've had each of the last 3 months. But this is the fourth and final one leading up to the final report that was mandated by the legislature that is due to the governor, the House, and the Senate next Monday on November 30th. So I'd just like to make everyone aware that this meeting is being recorded, as the previous ones were. A copy of today's recording will be posted on our website beginning of next week. And for those of you who have maybe missed the prior public meetings, feel free to go out to our website. The recordings are out there. You could do your catch up by listening to those recordings if you'd like to do that. Also, those on the phone that are not here, you can find all the meeting materials. They are going to be on the agency's website at aca.myflorida.com. And when you get there, you need to click on the hyperlink that is titled Medicaid. Then scroll down the table, and you will see a page. And on that page, there will be a hyperlink titled Hospital Outpatient Prospective Payment Reimbursement Methodology. And then you should see a copy of today's agenda along with the slide deck that's out there as well that the Navigant will go through today. So also, in addition, there is a webinar as well. And that link to that webinar is on our website at that same location. So I will like to also say, just as previously, for those of you in the room who would like to make a public comment or ask questions, you are free to do so. But I would like to ask that you please hold the microphone up to your mouth and state who you are and what organization you're with. And we will make sure we get you a microphone out there. And then we'll also go to the phone line and unmute the line and periodically through the presentation to ask if there's any questions there as well, but we'll hit up the room first. So with that, I appreciate everyone being here to listen to this last presentation that we have, and we can begin the meeting. And with that, I will turn it over to the crew at Navigant. So with me again is Mal Ferguson, who will be going through the slide deck. And we also have Jim Pedersen here as well that will chime in as we go through the information. So with that, Mal.
Okay, thanks, Tom. Good afternoon to everyone. Thanks for spending a little bit of time with us on this Friday afternoon. We figured that was going to be a little better than doing it during the week of Thanksgiving. Hopefully some of you are going to have some time off. As Tom said, this is the fourth public meeting, and we have at this point now come up with a set of recommendations for how the payment method will look that will be put in the report going to the legislature and to the governor in about a week. It's due, a week from Monday actually it is due. The governance committee has met twice since we've last met in a public meeting. So we're gonna go through all the results of what the governance committee has described and kind of quickly show you our latest simulation, which is simulation number 7 of EAPG pricing.
And Mal, if I can mention one other thing, I'm glad you brought up the governance committee meeting. On our website as well, you should be able to find the results of those governance committee meetings through, I believe, the November 6th governance committee meeting. We have also had one earlier this week that Mal will discuss the decisions as he goes through the presentation.
Can you go back? All right, as a quick agenda, again, we're going to go through the decisions or recommendations that have been agreed to by the governance committee, the internal committee here at ACA with Navigant input. There are about, I think there are 5 items on there that are new since the last time we met. Then we're going to go through the results of Simulation 7, which apply those recommendations. And then finally, Section 3 here, or our last thing, is that we're going to go through a kind of a review of the entire list of policy decisions. And we can do that kind of quickly. Some of that will be a review of things we've already talked about today. But just I've got a couple of slides that kind of summarize all of the decisions or recommendations anyway. in a concise manner, so we can go through that quickly. My plan is to stop after each section in case anyone either in the room or on the phone wants to ask a question. And then, of course, it doesn't say that on the agenda here, but it does on the ACCA agenda, that you're welcome to public comment towards the end of the meeting. Okay. All right, so we have a series, so we're just going to go through here some of the policy decisions that have been that we've talked about with the Governance Committee over the last two meetings. We met in the first week of November and then again 2 days ago. And these are all policy decisions that are part of our standard checklist that we have shown in previous meetings, previous public meetings, of the items that we think are necessary to decide as part of an EAPG or outpatient payment, prospective payment system. So the first one we're going to go through today is outliers, whether or not we're going to have outliers in this payment method. From what we understand, there are six states that Medicaid agencies who have put in EAPGs so far. None of them have chosen to have an outlier. And outliers generally are not quite as good a fit in an outpatient payment method as an inpatient one, but we'll talk about that more as we go. And then just for comparison, Medicare, who uses APCs in their outpatient method, does use outliers. They have a fixed outlier cost threshold or fixed loss threshold of $2,700, $2,775, for the current year. And in proposal, anyway, I read that they're suggesting increasing it, I think, kind of significantly to $3,650. I don't know offhand if that has been approved or not. Some of you in the room may know. But anyway, a relatively high fixed loss threshold and a marginal cost percentage of 50%. So if the loss for the hospital is greater than that, then 50% of the costs above threshold are paid by Medicare through an outlier. We'll talk about this a little bit more, but to kind of give you the punchline, the recommendation we've come up with is not to have an outlier payment as part of the Florida Medicaid prospective payment system. So our plan or our recommendation so far is not to have any outlier payments. What we did do, kind of quick, is run a pretty quick estimate of what would the outlier payments look like for a couple of different fixed loss thresholds, just to see how much money we were talking about. And we did it with an 80% marginal cost factor, which is more consistent really with the inpatient method, but we just picked something so we could look at some numbers quickly. So our marginal cost factor in these numbers here is actually higher than what Medicare does. And even with that, with a fixed loss threshold of $2,000, we were talking about 2% of payments would go out as outliers. And obviously as the thresholds get higher, less and less money is paid out as an outlier, and more in the base rate. So the conclusion, I think, of the Governance Committee was looking at numbers that are this low in terms of payments that would go out in the form of an outlier, that it was not worth the complexity that it adds to the payment method to include outliers as part of the payment. So the recommendation as of now is no outliers. And either way, of course, this is always budget neutral. So even if there was an outlier payment, the result of that is would have to be lower base rate to make some money available to go out as an outlier payment. The second policy decision that we've talked about since our last public meeting is related to policy adjusters. And I'm going to talk about them in detail and kind of explain what this chart is. But in general, very similar to the inpatient method, we usually look at two different primary types of policy adjusters. One would be a service adjuster, and the other is a provider-specific adjuster or an adjuster that would apply to a category of providers. So that's the way we did it with inpatient, and it actually is a good fit in the way we think of it for outpatient as well. So to decide if we needed any policy adjusters, one of the things we do is look at the pay-to-cost ratios both of those types of categories, by service and then by category of hospital. So the first chart we have up here, slide 6, is by category of service. In these charts, the next couple of charts anyway, the only data we're including here is hospital data. There's no ASC data. Again, because we're looking at pay-to-cost ratios, and we don't have a very good way to measure cost in an ASC. So we've left them out of these particular charts. Anyway, what you can see is for various services, there's obviously a very broad range of payment-to-cost ratios. The statewide ratio in aggregate is 75% of cost across the entire program for all the hospitals. And so when looking at this, if we were to put in a policy adjuster, it would be for services that are paid well below the statewide average. That would kind of be the areas generally that would stand out to us as areas that might need some help. And what we find is there really aren't that many service lines or categories of service that are below the statewide average. And those that are below the statewide average tend to be services that are bundled in an EAPG payment. So they're services that we kind of expect payment to be relatively low because their payment is included on other line items that would show in a chart like this in a different category of service. So looking at the right-hand side of the chart, at the laboratory, diagnostic testing, supplies, all of those tend to have some bundling. So the fact that they are below statewide average, we consider acceptable given what we understand about the payment method. And the last couple on there, that in all honesty, their volume is so low, it's hardly worth thinking about them. So now after looking at service adjusters, we're going to look at provider-specific or provider category adjusters and see if we have a need for anything there. And again, we're looking at the statewide average as compared to the pay-to-cost for an individual category of hospitals. And most of them actually are relatively close to the statewide average. So there really isn't a whole lot that jumps out here as needing a policy adjuster. Out of state is kind of low. I don't know why. Kind of strange. We can't quite figure that one out yet, but we're not going to make an adjuster for out-of-state hospitals. The one bar that is kind of interesting is this rehabilitation showing. This is freestanding rehab facilities showing at 270% of cost. That's a little odd. I don't, in honesty, have a very good explanation as to why yet, or it just may be a function of the way EAPG payment works. I can tell you that these are stays that are almost all therapies, physical therapies generally, maybe occupational and speech. It is kind of interesting that their pay-to-cost is so high. We could at some point consider maybe putting in a policy adjuster that is less than one for that. So maybe more to come on that, may not, maybe not. The total amount of money that we pay that shows up in that line is $7 million. So, in a budget of $1.2 billion, even if we'd make an adjustment, it's not going to have a significant shift of money in any direction. But there is one other in here. That we did decide on one provider category policy adjuster, which actually is already in the data in simulation 7. So the numbers here already show that or reflect that adjuster. And that is for high Medicaid outpatient utilization hospitals. So hospitals that have a high percentage of their payments that's coming from Medicaid, specifically in their outpatient business, because it's an outpatient payment method. And I'll go through a couple slides in a minute to show you who those hospitals are. They turn out somewhat as expected. They turn out to be the three big children's hospitals. So that's why there's a little note here at the bottom that before the adjuster, the children's hospitals were at 82% pay to cost. Now they are at 91, which is because of the benefit of the policy adjuster that is included as part of this particular simulation. So the recommendation is, so far anyway, is to have one policy adjuster. So first of all, zero service line adjusters. There wasn't anything clearly that stood out as needing a service adjuster. But one provider category adjuster is included, and it is for hospitals that have a high utilization of outpatient, Medicaid services. And then the goal right now is to set four hospitals that qualify for that category to set their pay-to-cost ratio at 90%. So that would kind of, we would calculate what that amount is, and that would become the budget for the that's used to determine the policy adjuster for that set of hospitals. So who made the list? Here's our list. So it is the three children's hospitals, which we sort of expected, but didn't know if there would be others that would fall into the category of having, you know, real high Medicaid utilization. So far anyway, and I'll explain in a minute why I'm caveat this a bit, but so far our threshold is 35%, any hospital with 35% or above Medicaid outpatient utilization falls into this category and applies for this or receives this policy adjuster. The numbers that are here were calculated off of cost reports, the cost reports that the hospitals, that you all submit to Medicaid, that are used, in particular, these numbers were calculated from the cost reports that were used to calculate the outpatient rates for the current fiscal year. So they're cost reports that were received by the agency, I believe, by April 15th, I think is the date of 2015. The interesting thing about this is that and then you can see how we calculated utilization is simply Medicaid total cost divided by overall cost from all payers, from all types, all services, and all patients cared for at each facility. The interesting thing here is that we believe on these cost reports that the Medicaid number we're using is a fee-for-service only number, that doesn't have managed care in it. And the time frame of these reports may overlap with the start of the Medicaid, the Managed Medical Assistance Program here in Florida. So depending on how much the cost report from any individual hospital overlaps with the move to managed care, that may significantly affect their percentages. So because of that, our plan is to recalculate these numbers using a different source. We've actually just put in a request to the Florida Data Center, which has terrific data, to see if they can give us, and I believe they can, give us numbers that we can use to estimate Medicaid utilization by hospital more accurately than what we've done here. And it is their numbers that we use to do a similar kind of estimate for inpatient a couple years back when we put in DRGs. So there's at least a chance that these numbers may change, or you know, the threshold might change, or the list of hospitals might change slightly, but I don't really expect it to change significantly. So if you want any of those details of how this was calculated now, that's on this slide 10 that I just went through. What we did now and simply makes the point that we plan to recalculate them. And we do expect, I shouldn't commit for them, but they've already responded, I think we're going to have the data in the next couple of days, which means in the report itself, I hope to have an updated set or list of hospitals that we're recommending to apply for the policy adjuster. Another policy decision is whether or not to have a charge cap. And a charge cap is kind of a standard policy that says you pay the lesser of the allowed amount or benefit amount or charges, lesser of allowed amount or charges. So on the rare occasion where the Medicaid payment amount or allowed amount is higher than charges, it's common to cut the allowed amount down to charges. And we do that today. Florida Medicaid does that in its inpatient payment method, and we actually do it today in the outpatient payment method with the per diems that are paid today. However, under EAPGs, charge cap doesn't fit quite as well. For example, there's a lot of bundling, as we've talked about in previous meetings. So there are several line items. It's common to have line items on a claim that pay at zero because their payment is covered under the payment in a different line item. Because of that, applying charge cap at the line level doesn't seem quite fair because the payment on a given line may apply to multiple lines, but we don't have an easy way to identify what are those other multiple lines and get all their charges applied, you know, added up to compare to the allowed amount to do our charge cap. So we'd prefer not to do a charge cap at the line level. The other option potentially would be to do a charge cap at the claim header level, where at least there we have total payment and total charges. And the formula certainly would be easy. But having a payment method that calculates some of its payment at the claim header and some of it at the claim line is kind of a complicated method and usually adds significant complexity to the overall method. So you can tell where I'm going. We're going to suggest not having a charge cap. We did take a quick look at what were we talking about if we did. So we have this model data set. It was easy enough to look at it, say how many claims. We looked at it, again, at the claim header level because we didn't think line level was fair. Looked at it at the header level and said how many claims would actually hit the charge cap and how much money would be involved. And the answer was 250,000 claims and $39 million, or about 3% of total payments. And our thought was that for the added complexity of doing this, it's not worth it for $39 million. And this is never intended to be a savings to the state. If in fact we put in a charge cap, that $39 million would go back into the base rate and be distributed across all the claims that are below charge cap. So decision are we looking at reducing payments in total. But it's just a matter of whether we would, on individual claims, reduce payment because it was above charges. So, final conclusion is just doesn't seem worth the complexity. We're suggesting don't bother with a charge cap with an EAPG payment methodology. All right, the next topic that was discussed is a documentation and coding improvement adjustment. For those who were around and followed through on the DRG method, this is somewhat similar anyway. It's not exactly the same, but it is very similar. Again, we do all of our modeling off a historical data set where the claims were billed and paid under a different payment method, and we're using them. It's the best information we have, so we're using that information to estimate the new payment method. In the inpatient world, for the folks that were there and remember that, the risk was that the case mix or average DRG relative weight might be a little low on the historical data where payment did not depend on diagnosis and procedure codes. So we made an adjustment under the expectation that the diagnosis and procedure code coding or inclusion on the claims is likely to improve in the future. There's a similar sort of phenomenon here in the outpatient world. Not so much case mix, which is or relative weight, but we have quite a large number of claim line items that were billed without a procedure code. And procedure codes are not required today under the current payment method, but they are required to receive payment under the new EAPG method. So the expectation here is that the inclusion of procedure codes is going to improve on claims going forward, and that has a result of more claim lines being paid. And we need to take that into consideration when we calculate our base rate, or we risk spending more money than the state had in Tom's budget. and this phenomenon, as the second bullet says, this phenomenon should only apply to hospitals. The ACs bill on a CMS 1500 claim form, and procedure codes are required on a CMS 1500. So there's no expectation of any room for improvement on the ASCs. So for this particular conversation, we're really only talking hospitals. And as a specific number, we did calculate in our data set, there's over 500,000 lines with blank procedure codes, even when we exclude those services where we thought we could estimate what the procedure code was. And this number also does not consider the hospitals that we actually took out of the data set because they had so many lines that with blank procedure codes. So with all those considerations in mind, Governance Committee is recommending a 5% adjustment to the EAPG base rate to account for anticipated documentation and coding improvement. I believe in this payment method, unlike the inpatient one where there were outliers, this I think will literally translate into a 5% reduction in base rate. In inpatient, it was something close to the same percentage. The 5% number is consistent with the number that was used, that the legislature picked for the inpatient method that went live 3 years ago. And we are going to recommend, as is done now in the inpatient method, is that there's a mid-year review of the actual claim data that we've received in and see how does it compare to the historical data we were using, and is there really justification for this 5% adjustment? And if we're off, either we've reduced the base rate too much or we haven't reduced the base rate enough, then there's room towards the second half of the year to potentially do some adjustments to payments for what's left in the year. And again, this is consistent with what is done in the inpatient world right now. And the last one for this section, and then we can open it up for questions, is the timing of the implementation. Anything we say related to timing is speculation because there really is no direction yet from the legislature to implement EAPGs. We think they are going to recommend it in this session, but there's no guarantee of that. But for now, anyway, we are moving forward under the assumption that they will recommend the agency move to EAPG pricing for the next state fiscal year. So with that in mind, but the agency's already started to work with the fiscal agent and try to figure out what it would take to do this. And the fiscal agent has said the best we can do probably is the fall of next year for an implementation. So, I'm intentionally being a little vague there. We're not committing to a specific date yet. It's a little too early for that. But we're saying that the aim, again, if the legislature directs the agency to move forward, the aim is to implement this payment method sometime in the fall of next year, most likely having it retroactive back to July 1, because payment methods and rates in the state generally are updated at the beginning of a state fiscal year. So we'd be talking about adjusting some claims for some 2 or 3 month period or whatever it turned out to be. And then with that in mind, we're planning to put a new edit into FEMIS, and there'll be more announcements about this, but a new edit into the MMIS that's going to require procedure codes on outpatient claims as of July 1, because we wouldn't want to do a retroactive adjustment back and use an EAPG payment method on claims that are littered with lines with no procedure code. So the plan as of now is to make that a billing rule change in an edit in the MMIS requiring procedure codes about 7 months out from now. So this hits a good breaking point. So we thought we would kind of open it up to see if anyone has specific questions so far.
John Owens, and I've got a couple, but starting with the outliers, did you see any pattern of specific hospitals or services like children that were creating, when you did look at the outliers, that were creating the outliers, were they for a certain claim type?
To be honest, we didn't look at it that hard. The answer is I don't know, but it would not be a terribly difficult thing to do. So we could look into it and see if there are patterns of types of facilities or something like that.
Okay. Because I guess that was leading to the next one on the policy adjuster. I know that you're looking at Medicaid utilization, which obviously the freestanding children, the bulk of their business, a lot of it's Medicaid. But also, did you look at, or I don't know if you've looked at it or not, like in the DRG, we have a service adjuster for under 21 for neonates and pediatrics, because there are quite a few hospitals in the state that have basically run children's hospitals within the hospital. And I didn't know if any way I've looked at those to see what the impact on those hospitals are going to be, because a lot of their losses may get masked by the or their percentages by the overall adult population they've got in those facilities as well. And is a service adjuster something that could be looked at for the pediatrics I know it's not simple, or under 21?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and again, unfortunately, the answer I need to give you is that we haven't looked at it in detail, but it's another thing we really could look at. As you saw with our list of service lines, we did not distinguish pediatric versus adult in them, mm-hmm. which is something we did in the inpatient. We did distinguish pediatric and adult in most of the service lines. So we haven't looked at it specifically across age groupings, but it would be a relatively easy thing to do, and so I think that's a good point.
On the coding adjustment of 5%, if you do a mid-year, I think we do it, January 31st? It's either February or with March 1 implementation, I think. The majority of claims are in managed care. So how are you? I mean, you're going to have a very small piece in the fee-for-service population. Is that going to be enough to even tell you what the real case mix is? And secondly, managed care rates are set October 1. So if you say that there has to be a coding adjustment in March 1st, whatever dollar amount is downward, how's that going to, and you would come back and decrease the decrease the hospital rates going forward? How would you account for that in the managed care rates? Because hospitals are paid off of what the published rate is for Medicaid. So if you decrease that rate going forward, the managed care companies would then have to pay the hospitals less, but yet their rates would still be established on the higher rates you set in October.
Yeah, in all honesty, you're absolutely right, first of all. And the logistics of that we haven't thought all the way through yet. I think we'd have a little challenge with how do we recoup the rates, because I think in general, at least in the inpatient world, we have said we're not going to change the cap rate in mid-year.
Right.
So we can adjust our fee for service, but the volume has become so low that is that really going to add or recoup significant money from any hospital? So I think logistically we're going to have some things to work through there. In terms of measuring case mix, and then I think Jim has a comment, but in terms of measuring case mix, we are planning to use both fee-for-service and managed care claim data. So the encounters that come into FEMIS would be used to measure the billing practices and case mix and so forth of the claims during the year.
Right. Yeah, it's just a concern because, yeah, and it would go over back to inpatient too now, especially since we're fully a year into the implementation. It's all managed care. You drop that rate in March for a hospital, that's what they're going to be theoretically stuck with from March to the remainder of their contract period until it changes again with the managed care company. And since the cap rates aren't changed, there seems like there would be a win. I didn't want the hospitals to take a hit for that, and then the other side of the equation didn't get adjusted accordingly.
Go ahead if you want.
Yeah, and this is Jim Pedersen from Navigant. Just one other thing to think about on that question about the managed care stuff, because I think what Mal's describing in terms of measuring it, looking at encounter claims too, is consistent with what we've done in other states. In Washington, for example, we actually look at both fee-for-service and encounter data when we are looking at this adjustment specifically. But the other thing too is we just need to make sure we're communicating effectively to the plans so that they know, because it's really not, I mean, the state can adjust the cap rate or not, but if you think about it, it probably makes, you know, I mean, it's sort of a very fine line as to whether or not you should try to adjust for this out of the cap rate or not, because really it's the obligation of the plans to be negotiating a similar kind of an adjustment with the hospitals with those managed care contracts, because it's going to, because the risk is to the plans for the upcoding or for the increase in coding. And so there, my assumption is that they would take that into consideration in their negotiations with in their contracting with the providers if they're going to move toward EAPGs.
Anything else, John?
No, for this section. No,
okay. Good. Let's. We're going to try more questions in the room, and then we'll open it to the phone.
Clint Shoup, just a couple questions. Could you talk me through when you talked about changing the data set to a 2015-2016 data set? Were you looking at? Because I'm trying to remember specifically what you had said about. Let's see. Simulation 7 used cost reports from 15-16. I guess you just took me through. Are you still using the data set from 13, but then overlaying that on cost data from 15-16, or am I just missing what the change there was?
Well, it's a good question. They're kind of two different things, but I can explain that. In terms of estimating the budget or amount of money that we're going to distribute under the base rate, we are taking this 13-14 data set and repricing the claims under 15-16 rates. So, you know, matches kind of what you're saying there. And then we sum that up, and that becomes our total dollar amount to spend. We actually have one new simulation coming out where we then increase that by 2%, which is the standard inflationary increase that's been done in the past. But that is for calculation of the base rate and the calculation of claim payments. So separately, the numbers that we are looking at for costs from 15-16 were only being used to determine Medicaid utilization. So really, the time frames of those would be whatever the cost report time frame was for the hospitals, you know, that had reports submitted by April of last year. So the time frames may vary by hospital, and was not really used to calculate rates. It was only used to identify which hospitals have high Medicaid utilization.
And I have some of the same questions that John mentioned about how you can capture in, kind of broadly speaking, children who are having higher acuity conditions and where those losses may be coming from, but we can talk about that later. But I guess one question I had is that how do you factor in the changes happening in the LIP world and their impacts on the outpatient rates, especially in a setting where, I mean, if you're going to set for a certain small subset of providers at 90% of cost, basically, but if LIP filters out of that as LIP is reduced, does that then adjust to 60% of cost, or do they end up just taking a much, does their adjuster actually adjust significantly higher to account for the loss associated with a reduction in LIP that's happening?
Yeah. The cost is obviously calculated completely separately from payment, right? So whether LIP is up or down, that does not affect the number of 90% of cost. But the beyond that, we really have, for the most part, considered the changes in LIP to be independent of this and not strongly considering the effect of LIP on the policy of the outpatient payment method. So if there are hospitals that are, you know, specifically losing under LIP because LIP is decreasing in size, we did not factor that in when trying to think of what could we possibly do with the outpatient money.
I guess I'm just my concern would be that the hospitals currently receiving LIP or LIP in the simulation as you run it, I presume you based when you kind of listed out different pay to cost ratios, you based that on including an all inclusive number, which includes their LIP number, right?
It does not.
So that is
It is purely okay. And so thank you. That's a good question really. The pay to cost calculations we're using are straight from claim data. So we're measuring cost as a cost to charge ratio times charges on the claims. And the payments are purely claim payments. So LIP, which is outside the claims, right, and paid quarterly, that is not factored in to the payments in the pay to cost ratios.
So the Medicaid out, and this is where I get, and I immediately get very confused on LIP as it relates to outpatient. So the Medicaid outpatient LIP payments are not paid on a per claim basis.
There is automatic rate enhancements.
I mean, I thought they were Medicaid outpatient rate impacts that were tied into LIP.
The automatics are included.
The automatic rate enhancements that are part of the outpatient per diem today.
This year
out of GR.
They're not funded through LIP. So there's no funding through LIPs with the outpatient rate enhancement.
Maybe we talk. Heard them as supplemental payments then.
Yep, fair enough. But those are in. Those are included in the numbers here. Anything that is distributed at the claim level is included in the numbers we have here.
So I guess my point would be then that if it is including any level of Medicaid supplemental payments in the simulation, and you're kind of pegging, saying these couple hospitals, we're going to peg you at a certain pay to cost ratio, and we'll adjust your adjuster to keep you there at 90% over time. Then if the underlying Medicaid supplemental payments that are helping impact that change, then presumably you're going to have to dedicate a lot more general revenue to help them stay at 90% if that Medicaid supplemental piece drops away. And so I guess my question would be, in that circumstance, do you envision that 90% number drops to 80% if the Medicaid supplemental payments go away, or how would that adjust? Because it concerns me that impacts the base rate for the broader system as well.
Yep, and it's an interesting point. And one quick little thing I'll add is that, just so you know, the way we have modeled the automatic rate enhancements in what we've done so far is to model them exactly the way they are distributed today in the current year. The way we've drawn it up so far anyway is that 90%, if it was, you know, if it was accepted by the legislature, would be kind of held static, which means if they received less money through automatic rate enhancements, you're correct, that we would now need to have a higher policy adjuster to keep them at 90% pay to cost. Now that number could be reviewed every year as automatic rate enhancements are reviewed, but if it was held steady, that is the effect that would occur.
Okay. Thanks. And then I think that's it for now. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks, Clint.
Sorry, I got one more real quick.
And within the outpatient, there these do not make any distinguishment for graduate medical education, right? There's no add-ons or anything built into this that would account if the facility has graduate medical education?
Correct. No effect on the rates for outpatient. Yeah, anyone else in the room, or we'll ask the folks on the phone.
Presentation mode is now disabled.
Hi, the phone is now open if anyone else on the line has a question.
Hey, Mal, it's Scott Davis.
Hi, Scott.
Hey, thanks for the information here. Got an interesting one for you. On November 2nd, Monday at the start of the month, CMS posted a final rule on Medicaid access. And the effective date of that is January of 16. And it kind of points out that any changes that the state makes to its payment methodologies need to be reviewed in light of what they could do to patient access. And it kind of sets some standards for the state to follow in what kind of information they have to look at for evaluating that. It doesn't make any predetermined conclusions on what changes to payments do, but it does set out a methodology that the state is supposed to follow in evaluating what it could do. And I didn't know if that was, I don't think it was contemplated as part of this report because it just came out a couple weeks ago, but I don't know if the state has thought through what it might have to do in trying to get a change like this implemented should the legislature approve that.
This is Jim Pedersen at Navigant, and that's a great question, and it's a question that we have discussed with the governance committee. And I think, you know, at this point, we probably can't respond to how the state would move forward with that requirement. I think there's some question as to how applicable it might be to these services, and so on. But we can clarify. Or put together a response to that question and share it and include it in our report. But it's that new policy, we're aware of it, and it's under consideration by folks here at AHCA, and we'll be addressing that in our report.
Thank you.
Either more from Scott or anyone else on the phone.
Yes, this is Gary Creighton from Health Management Associates. Will you be publishing in the report or put on the website the simulation net impact for all hospitals? Now you have the top 20 for both winners and losers. Will you publish the full list?
Yep, good question, Gary, and the answer is yes, we will. Actually, after this meeting, and I was planning to mention that in a few minutes anyway, but after this meeting, we will post spreadsheets that list all of the hospitals in the state of Florida and separately all the ASCs, and a comparison of what we call baseline payment or payment under the current method versus the new method. So that will be available. We are also working on a new simulation that is really only very subtly different than what we will be posting today, but it will be the new simulation that we will include in the report. And what I kind of picture is that we'll have an appendix that would list the results for all hospitals in probably an identical format to what we post on the spreadsheet today.
Okay, thank you.
Great, anything else?
Presentation mode is now enabled.
Okay, thank you all for your questions. Those are all very good questions. We're going to move forward and kind of review Simulation 7 in some level of detail, and I know for most folks what you really want to see is the spreadsheet of how it affects your hospitals or hospital systems. So we don't have to spend hours and hours on this, but we'd like to go through it at least a little bit, and then as we mentioned, we'll have the data available in detail. For those in the room, I think we even have hard copies here. Yes, we do. Kind of an important point so we want to start with is slide 18 here. We did take several hospitals out of the modeling because they had a limited number, or they had a large number of service lines with blank procedure codes. And we really just kind of drew a line in the sand and picked a percentage and said anyone with blank lines above a certain percentage, we are going to remove them from the data set because we don't feel that their data is going to be really reflective of what the data will look like in the future. So we're showing here the list of hospitals. The number we had picked was 33%. If 33% of their lines had blank procedure codes or more, we did exclude certain specific services that are listed in the notes at the bottom. But anyway, for most services, if the percentage of lines that had blank procedure codes was more than 33%, they came out of the data set. And the specific list is here. In the notes, there actually are two hospitals listed that we're saying we meant to take out of the data set, and we did not take them out. In fact, there's really only one. The Florida Hospital in Tampa met the criteria, but accidentally was not removed from the data set. In the new simulation, we have that corrected, and their data will not be included. There is a plan. There was some direction from the governance committee that we work on reaching out to the hospitals in this list and see if they can get us a claim data set that in a format that we could use to merge with what we have and get procedure codes added to their claim data. And if we can do that, then we will add them into any future simulations that go on. Given the short time frames of when the report was required, we're down to a week. We're not expecting to add anyone in before the report is written, but we will obviously state that these are the caveats of the report as it's written. And in the future, we're assuming that the legislature is going to ask for simulations and some modeling going forward. So with that in mind, if hospitals can get us data that we can use to bring them back into the modeling, we hope to be able to do that over the next month or two and have it available for the legislature as they ponder this payment method. So I have a quick summary here of the results, or the characteristics maybe, of Simulation 7. We have three hospitals that hit the high Medicaid utilization number, which we've talked about, the three larger freestanding children's hospitals. We have two base rates. This is consistent with what we had in the last presentation, one for hospitals and one for ASCs. New again with this one is this provider policy adjuster for those three hospitals. No service adjusters, no outliers, no charge cap, all things we've mentioned. And we actually did just mention recently that the automatic rate enhancements, which happened to total almost $134 million, are being modeled as a supplemental payment on top of the EAPG payment, goes out per claim, and uses, in our modeling, the exact same distribution that is used today for the current fiscal year in outpatient claims. The next slide I won't spend much time on, but if you're a numbers person and really want to see some more detail of how much money is being distributed to this method and how much is ASC versus hospital versus high Medicaid utilization, it's all there for you. And again, quickly, I really think we don't have to spend a whole lot of time on this, but we do like to look at various different ways in addition to specific hospital by hospital. We like to look at other ways of measuring how does this current payment method or the new payment method compare to the current one. So one of the ways we do that is by service line. And I do think John brings up an interesting point. Our service lines, as we've drawn them up now, does not distinguish pediatric and adult. It may be interesting to look at that. But by service line, there really are significant changes under the new payment method because the two methods are just so different. The current method pays the exact same amount for every billable line item, no matter whether it's for an inexpensive drug or for a very expensive procedure or device or anything. The new method is much more aligned with, I think, the costs of the services provided on individual services. So that's good, but at the same time, it also bundles several services. So there are services like supplies that were receiving payment under the old method that receive very little payment under the new method. So at the service line level, there are significant changes. Of course, in aggregate, this is a budget-neutral change in payment. And then again, we looked at a chart that was similar to this. This is by provider category. This is pay to cost again. And again, sorry, Peter, only hospitals because we don't have costs for ASCs. And shows what their pay to costs were under the per diem method and what they are under, or modeled to be anyway, under the EAPG method. And again, the statewide average is 75% in aggregate across the entire program. So I'll go through this very quickly, but we do list the top 20 hospitals in terms of dollar amount of increases in reimbursement and then decreases of reimbursement. We did pick our top 20 by dollar amounts, which means that smaller hospitals probably wouldn't show up in here, whether they're seeing big increases or big decreases. Simply their size might preclude them from being in this list, but we will have a full list for everyone to see. So we have increases and decreases, and then we have a couple of charts beyond that that show it for the top 20 ASCs also. It would be nice to have a payment method with very few changes, but I think given the change that's being suggested here, I think that's unrealistic. I think, unfortunately, there will be increases and decreases in reimbursement in aggregate for individual hospitals because we're moving from cost-based hospital-specific rates to really down to three rates, arguably you could say now, one for ASCs, one for high Medicaid utilization hospitals, and one for everybody else. So we're going from hospital-specific rates down to just two or three rates, and the result of that is going to have impacts on individual facilities. If you're curious about the case mix, we never said it anywhere. I didn't have a table that said it. The average case mix is 1.29 for the state. So if you're looking at your hospital and trying to decide, is your case mix higher or low, that's the average, 1.29. And that's the average combined ASC and hospital, right?
Correct.
And we could figure it out if you'd like, but I don't happen to know off the top of my head what is the case mix for ASCs separate from hospitals. But we could figure it out. ASCs do tend to actually be quite a lot higher in case mix. And as a general rule, again, you can think that, you know, what these are broad rules, but similar to the inpatient method when we made the change, what are the things that are affecting payment? And again, these are kind of broad strokes, but if you're a hospital that had a high per diem and you were high cost, you're liable to see a decrease moving to this type of method. If you're a hospital that had relatively low costs, or ASC, well, ASCs are a little different, sorry, because they weren't paid on a cost-based method. But for hospitals, if you were relatively low cost and low per diem, you're liable to see an improvement in your reimbursement when we go to this method that's more averaging out. The other thing is the case mix. If your case mix is higher than average, that's going to result in higher payments for you. And if the case mix is lower than average, then just the way the math works, that's going to lower payments. Which is why that 1.29 number is kind of helpful. So I really only have a couple more slides. My thought is to just go ahead and go through them, and then we can open it up to more questions if anyone has them. So what I wanted to do is this section three here is just review the full list of policy decisions quickly that we've worked through and talked about in the Governance Committee and in the public meetings over the last 3 or 4 months. And many of these I'll go through quickly because they're reviews of things we've already talked about. But anyway, the recommendation is for we knew it would be an outpatient prospective payment system. That was what was asked for by the legislature. But the recommendation specifically is to do it with EAPGs, Enhanced Ambulatory Patient Groups. As we've talked about, the other common option that was being considered was APCs, which is what Medicare uses. The data set is from fiscal year 13-14, includes fee-for-service and managed care. And maybe the most interesting or most important thing here is that we had to take some hospitals out of the list because we didn't feel the data was complete enough. And again, if we can fix that over the next month or two, we will do that. Provider types included, as of now, the recommendations are hospitals and ASCs. There are a couple other facilities that bill on an outpatient claim form, but the Governor's Committee has decided to carve them out of this payment method, at least for now, and those are freestanding labs, dialysis centers, and hospice. Actually, I think freestanding labs may bill on a CMS 1500. But in terms of services, for any facility that is carved into the payment method, all of their outpatient services are carved into the payment method. So as of now, we're not excluding any individual services. In terms of base rates, we have two, one for hospitals, one for ASCs. And consistent with the inpatient method, there is no wage area adjustment on the base rates. We mentioned this already. The automatic rate enhancements are being paid out per claim and not in the base rate. If they were in the base rate, they would be spread across all hospitals, not the ones that they're specifically identified for. For policy adjusters, we're going with one as our recommendation, and it is a provider adjuster. Again, we've spent time today already talking about that. No outliers. Transition period, I guess, consistent also with the inpatient method. The committee's recommendation is for no transition period, which means we'd be going live with the full change in payment method from day one. Documentation and coding improvement, 5% for hospitals, 0 for ASCs. Again, there's no reason to believe there's any room to change billing in ASCs. We mentioned the timing of the implementation, fall of next year. Presumably, again, this is all dependent on the legislature, but fall of next year, retroactive back to July 1. And the last bit, we do think there'll be one billing rule change, which would be to require procedure codes on all line items. The fiscal agent is actually looking at, are there any scenarios where you really don't need to include a procedure code on a line? If there's any scenarios where it doesn't make sense to include one, if there are, then they plan to add that as an exception to this rule. But and I'm not a certified coder, I don't know for sure, but we don't know of any specific scenarios where we'd have exceptions to this rule. But there at least, someone is looking into that. In terms of the 340B drug pricing program and the impact we're deciding is that, or the recommendation to the legislature is that there's not sufficient impact to make any changes specifically for drugs with this payment method. And one thing, in theory, we could do is carve them out, although then we'd have to come up with an entirely new payment method specifically for drugs. So anyway, as of now, drugs are carved into the payment method. And the last one we talked about is no charge cap. So I'm good. I'm all set. Let's open it up again for any more questions. Or public comment, actually.
David Weinberg with LivaNova Neuromodulation. Just two quick questions. The EAPG 3M version up in Washington State's, I believe, 3.11. Do you guys know which version potentially you would use here in Florida?
Yeah, the plan is 3.10, which is, as far as I know right now, is the most current version. Washington went live with 3.7. And I don't know if they've upgraded yet, but anyway, they were in an older version to start. But anyway, 3.10 is the answer here.
Okay, thanks. And the last question is, will there be a published list of CPT codes in the crosswalk over to level 4 nerve procedures? And if so, at what point would that be published?
You may have to educate us a little more on that. What do you mean by specific list of codes that are level 4?
CPT codes.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
What is the effect that they have on the APG method? Do you know?
I don't know specifically. I just know that one of my colleagues who had been working up in Washington State said that there was some kind of relationship involved with that. So he said that might be a good question for you guys to ask.
So what's the question again? I'm sorry.
A list of the CPT codes,
right,
and the crosswalk over to what he called level 4 nerve procedures.
Oh, related to the nerve, like the vagal nerve stimulator?
Yes, correct.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we can get that information.
Yes, I'm sorry. This is Jim Pedersen. So I think the question is around the vagal nerve stimulator procedure.
Yes.
Yeah, and that, which is a fairly costly procedure. We can get you some information on how that would be affected here off the top of my head, though I don't know how we're dealing with that, but we can look into that for you.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah. Good question.
You may know, but if not, it turns out Navigant's done quite a lot of work with Washington Medicaid and Jim specifically. So you're asking the right people.
Could y'all talk through the transition process? I guess because when you say it wouldn't actually happen until the fall, but we would have to, but it would be retroactive. Does that mean that for hospitals and for ASCs involved, we would effectively have to start 7/1 because we're going to have to start coding as if it's in place as of July 1st? And so I guess, how would that work? I mean, do you anticipate, I guess, is the issue, would 3M have everything that we need to start doing that by 7/1 for us? And I guess the second question is there from a statutory limitation on when you have to set these rates, is there a time certain date by which you'd have to have the rates implemented by 3M or the TPA, to even if you're going retroactive?
In general, the way we normally have the rates finished in time to include them in proviso language that the legislature would sign off on. So that would mean, I believe, first or second week of March of this particular year, unless something unusual. It might even be earlier. Okay. Session ends earlier than that. Okay. So under standard procedure, the rates would be finalized prior to completion of session. From 3M's point of view, which you're absolutely right, Clint, that you know they develop software and make it available and sell software that would model and match the payment method of the Medicaid agency. We do work with them closely and plan to give them all the information necessary to put the Florida model or logic into their system. I would expect, yes, they probably would be ready by July 1, given that time frame, but I can't commit specifically. And in general, from a coding perspective, certainly you could use their software as it exists now to assign EAPGs. The only piece of it that would be new that would have to be developed in the next few months would be the payment logic that mirrors the Florida Medicaid payment logic.
Yeah, and this is Jim. I would just add, generally, I think 3M can be way more nimble in their preparation of their products than a larger MMIS shop might be. I mean, I think because they're not dealing with, you know, all of the other stuff that you have to deal with an MMIS system at 3M. So developing a pricing model, I think, is a pretty straightforward. But even with that, you know, you're going to have that gap between actual finalization of the model in the fall and when it would be effective. And when 3M, my assumption is if 3M was able to release a product sometime before July 1st, that there may be some, you know, minor tweaks or adjustments that have to occur as a result of implementation of the MMIS, maybe? Is that fair, Mal, or...?
And honestly, I hope not.
I hope not. Yeah. But if there are, you know, there may be a little bit of a fix that 3M might have to make, but I would expect that it would be minor if there was anything at all. So I'm thinking it should be fine with 3M.
So I guess the issue, whatever issues that are preventing you from thinking it could be implemented, everything by July 1st, those are all MMIS issues?
Yes, yes.
Which don't impact the hospital from a coding perspective and a... I guess they would impact it from a payment perspective. I guess I'm trying to understand, like, is that 3-month delay or 2-month delay or whatever delay that is? Does that end up impacting us when it's to go back, when we end up going back retroactively?
Well, the only billing change that you need to make in preparation for this payment method is including procedure codes on the claims more than you do now, or at least some hospitals. Sure. I'm talking in general. And you would have to have that ready by July 1. Assuming the schedule goes as we've described here, you would need to be by July 1 have those changes in your system. And in fact, to try to ensure that happens, the plan as of now is to put an edit into the MMIS to deny line items without a procedure code in preparation for this. Beyond that, though, I don't think there's a lot in the way of changes in the way you bill your claims under this new method. You may, you know, for your own accounts receivable purposes, maybe want to purchase the software and be tracking how it's paid, but from a pure billing standpoint, there really aren't many changes.
Gotcha. And then and some of the feedback I had gotten from our coders was that when y'all led the transition to APR-DRGs on the inpatient side, there was a very effective document y'all put together that really helped the coders understand how the best way to transition kind of their processes going from the legacy system to APR-DRGs. So to the extent that you could consider that, again, in this process, they would ask to do so because, and again, that's way outside my understanding of what that document actually was, but I know that was something that has raised to me.
We worked on it yesterday. So, yes, the plan is to include one. We call them a calculator. We called it a DRG calculator, I think is what you're referring to, and we plan to have an EAPG calculator. It is... it is less user-friendly in the sense that you have to key more fields in on the outpatient side. You have to key in information on every single line. But from the point of view of communicating what are the formulas, it will serve that purpose well.
Right, but what's unique to EAPGs, with just a few very minor exceptions, the diagnosis code really doesn't come into play, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, you're really talking about just making sure procedure codes are being reflected in the claim, and our assumption is that your coders are already capturing all of those because that drives your revenues at your hospital. I mean, your revenue system's capturing those at the procedure code level. I would assume that's the case at most hospitals that are worried about their revenues, and so it's just a matter really of being able to transition that into the submission of a claim. And so it's really, in my mind, it's less of a coding issue than it is just actually documenting what you're already capturing in the claim itself.
So does that make you think that 5% DCI adjustment isn't going to be as needed as it would have been on an inpatient basis?
No,
the coding isn't as
no, because the issue that we have is that we don't have those codes in our data right now, and that's why we have the and so it's not, we don't expect your coders to be doing anything necessarily different at their end in this case, because it's really a one-to-one kind of a match when you're capturing your procedure codes for your internal revenue accumulation. Our assumption is you're already capturing everything you can. It's, our concern is that when we model these simulations, that we don't have all of your data because it's not included in the claim, because it hasn't been required in the claim. And that's why we're worried about the documentation coding.
Okay.
It's a little bit different than under inpatient.
And to the, just kind of last question on the transition process. In other states you've worked in, do you normally have a transition process by which you kind of roll into the new EAPG system, or what's been your past experience in other states?
For EAPGs, since outpatient is relatively a smaller universe of dollars compared to inpatient, I'm trying to think of where we've transitioned. There's probably an element of transition in our Illinois implementation, but in Washington there wasn't. We didn't do a transition in Washington, I don't believe. And we're also now engaged in Wisconsin. We didn't design and implement the system, but we're helping to manage it going forward. And there, that was a straight implementation too. I don't think there was a transition in Wisconsin either. So those are the states we're most familiar with.
And then last comment I would just make is, I mean, just looking at taking a cursory glance at the simulation of the top 20 hospitals with payment decreases, almost half of them have either a standalone children's hospital or an embedded children's hospital. And so, I mean, it seems just based on that, looking at that, like I said, on a cursory basis, there seems to be some sort of a potential pediatric impact. And so on the inpatient side, we've worked over the last several years to try to kind of build that back into the system when it was excluded to start. Not completely excluded, but try to increase that over the last several years. And so I would again encourage at least looking at options to consider both for the standalone hospitals, which definitely need it, as well as potentially for the embedded hospitals, to have some sort of adjustment, whether for these more severe cases or children under 21 or whatever, some options, so it's not destroying the base rate, but still addressing these pediatric cases. So.
Yeah, I think it's very valid to have us take a look at that and see what we can do. It'd be interesting to see how much we can get in prior to the report, because I don't want to drop anything in that we haven't reviewed with the governance committee. But I think that's a very valid point, and I think it's worthwhile to look at how does this affect different age categories, particularly pediatrics.
Thanks.
Back on the policy adjuster, what is the policy adjuster? I mean, what's the factor?
It is on one of the slides, 1.4463.
Okay, I can't read some of them, sorry.
1.4463.
And that's applied to basically once you've computed the outpatient, the base rate, it's then multiplied times the adjustment factor, and then the automatic is added on?
Yes, so very, very similar to the inpatient world. Yep.
Okay. The numbers, like in your simulation, I guess, I think it's, what, a $387 base rate for hospitals was in here?
Yep.
you pulled out a group of hospitals or several large facilities in there. Did you pull money out for those, or is it when you put those back into the simulation that 387 is going to go down?
We pulled their money out also.
Okay, so you pulled out some type of estimated impact for those hospitals?
Yeah, we simply, because the money that we use is simply a sum of the baseline payments in the claims in our data set. So once they come out of the data set, they simply don't contribute to that total baseline payment. And if they would go back in, then, of course, they add to it.
Okay. And then I guess the – and this goes back to the baseline. I think it's the last one. But the baseline is you were looking at 13-14 data set, and somehow you had the fee-for-service, and somehow I guess you got from the encounter data, managed care claims, and you priced them at the rates that were being paid?
We priced them at the fee-for-service rates.
Oh, fee-for-service.
Which is a bit of – admittedly, you know, maybe they have different rates with their contractors.
Right.
But –
and then you took those and are going to apply the 15-16 outpatient rate, and that's going to be your new baseline?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yep. And that added up to the $1.2 million or something that's in one of the charts that's particularly small here.
Okay.
$1.2 billion, sorry.
So we were using the – I was just trying to figure out – it may be figured in, calculated in there. That should take care of it. Okay. That's it.
Okay. And that number that – 1.44 numbers on slide 19 in a size that's generally readable. It's not the real small one.
Peter Lorengel, Florida Society of Ambulatory Surgical Centers. So I don't have complete familiarity with how an EAPG system works. So I'm just trying to be a small business who is running a surgery center. I've got two employees and who are working in the business office, and so I'm not a hospital, right? I'm trying to make that point. Two employees who are already running the surgery center. And so I now am being consulted with by my governing board that says, will we be able to participate in Medicaid after the date of implementation? And so I have to go through a study, and I have to ask certain questions. So let me ask a couple questions of you, because these are the questions our members will ask. So generally, how do you purchase the EAPG methodology so you can use it in your surgery center?
You would purchase it from 3M Health Information Systems, which presumably you'd find them on a website. You'd probably, especially in a small office like you're describing, you'd probably purchase a Microsoft Windows-based version of this software, which is very easy to implement. They will make a version available that not only does the assignment of EAPGs, but also mirrors the Florida Medicaid payment method, so it can literally bring you back not only the codes, but also a projection of payment. In a small office, you would use a little user interface where you key in a claim, and it would bring you back pretty much instantaneously an estimate of Florida Medicaid payment.
Okay, so that would be a price calculator type of a price calculator.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when you had said you're making a price calculator available, that's not the same thing. Each small business would have to buy their own price calculator.
First of all, it's not the same thing. So they are two different calculators, and I don't mean to make that confusing.
Yeah.
With the calculator that we create, that we were talking about with Clint, the user has to identify the EAPG code in five or six different flags that the 3M software returns and keys that in for each line, and then our calculator will calculate a price, generally, which means you need the software from 3M anyway to determine the EAPG. Which means you're generally not going to use our calculator, because if you're going to buy the 3M software, it's going to give you the price as well. It should, if we do our job right, give you the same dollar amount, but you might as well just use the 3M software.
Any idea how much the 3M software has cost in states where you've implemented previously?
I don't really. We have some ideas, but our ideas are all hospitals. It generally is based on claim volume. And so for a small facility, I'm sorry, but I don't have experience on what the rates are like.
Is there any way to research that? Does 3M have an idea right now? Is there a price schedule that might be available on the Internet? Or
I've never seen, I'm looking around to see if anyone else has, but I've never seen a specific price schedule on a 3M website that's detailed out. They seem to want to have you talk to a salesperson and work through it.
Okay. And so we have no idea right now whether we're talking about hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands. We just really don't know. I mean, we're setting a policy that we, for 433 ASCs, that'll affect 433 ASCs, and the only way they can even determine if they're going to participate in the Medicaid program is to buy a piece of software has an unknown price. I'm just going through how ASCs think. I have that correct?
Yeah. So we can talk to 3M if that's what you're thinking. I mean, yeah. See if they will offer some more information to us.
Well, I mean, we're going to be sharing our analyses with folks, aren't we? Will we be having any claim-specific data we can share?
Yes.
They'll have the historical data that we've used to look at and that's priced out.
You'll send that to the individual ASC?
Well, I mean, I think I'm not sure what the plan is here. I mean,
we have made it. Unfortunately, it requires a separate data use agreement. So
right.
We make it available to those entities, for example, your association, but also individual facilities, if they're willing to contact the agency and sign a data use agreement, then we will give them their data specific, you know.
Right. But but there won't be, like, if you were to go to a Medicaid manual, you'll see an appendix, and the appendix will list the amount of reimbursement to expect per procedure, CPT code, line item, and there's very little bundling, we understand. But it's able to be determined what the reimbursement would be from participation, and I just don't see that being possible here. I mean, I know the association can get data, and we'll work on that. But we could try and go out to people and say, well, this is kind of what the CPT codes are, but it depends on how they're bundling when you're doing one or two or three procedures together. So we really can't tell you what it's going to be unless you buy the software and key it in specifically the way the procedure is going to work. Are you nodding, Andrew? Is that correct? Okay. I didn't know if I'm just trying to make sure I'm understanding, since
right
now it's the fourth and final meeting and ASCs are still on the table.
Yeah, I think though that to the extent that providers are concerned about that decision and want to get the data from the state, and we can execute a data use agreement, we'll share with them the data that we've used to model historically, so they'll be able to see claim by claim how they would be paid under this new system. I mean if you want to be able to evaluate claims on a go-forward basis once the system is implemented and once the system is approved by the legislature, and want to look to see if I'm going to do this claim or that claim or not when someone comes to your entity or comes to your ASC to looking for a surgical procedure, you would need to have. If you could anticipate what all the services and what all the procedures and procedure codes would be included in that service going forward, if you had the 3M software, then you could enter it at that point and predict what that payment might be. I'm not sure if that's what you're asking.
Oh yeah, but that's how an ASC thinks. I mean,
that's fair. So in that case, you would have to have the 3M software.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Has the EAPG model ever been implemented in any other state, six states, for ASC?
I believe the answer is yes, but I honestly don't know. Maybe we can dig into that and see if we
can find out.
I'd
love to have that so I could network with them.
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head either.
Because I think it's important, because I think there's an enormous difference between a hospital and an ASC in this area. The complexities and just the concerns. And so by including both in this methodology, it may be pioneering. I don't know. That's why I'm very curious to see if it's happened anywhere else. The transition time. So if our legislature was so kind as to finish its 60-day session, say, in early March, as is planned, and it passed this, then there would be clearly a delay of some sort until the agency is able to start communicating about it. Maybe a reasonable delay, 30 days. So we're now somewhere in April. And if I understood Clint's line of questioning, We need to be prepared by July. That gives 90 days to turn an entire state around to a new reimbursement methodology. It would be my consideration that's just far too short. I mean, that is going to, in my estimation, that will stop the system dead in its tracks. It will not be possible. We can get through it, but I'm just saying it will. Nobody will know what to do. We can't learn that fast.
The hospitals had less warning for DRGs.
Yeah, but remember, I have two people in my billing office who are already working 60 hours a week trying to keep my ASC running, and now you're going to ask me to do this. And again, I'm trying to go from the point of doing this. What's the easy answer? The easy answer says, well, gosh, this is getting pretty rough. We'll just have to let Clint deal with those over in the hospitals. And we don't want that. Okay, so the last thing, and it goes with my overall point, is that I believe there'll be declining participation from ASCs in the Medicaid program. Okay, that's what I believe at this point, having listened to the four meetings. And so it seems as if as folks drop out of participation, that the pool won't be going down as quickly. So that adjustment factor should be returned. The adjustment factor should be raised, or whatever the factor is, should be raised so that at least the participating facilities are getting the full share of the pot. Following me? So just as there's going to be a decline or an adjustment to the hospital rate because there'll be more lines billed as the coding improves, it would seem appropriate that as ASCs are dropping out and other ASCs should benefit from picking up the rate adjustment as the pool stays the same. So maybe at that mid-year, at six-month adjustment, you could look at that and run the data and see. I hope I'm wrong, but I'm just saying maybe you could run the data and see if the participation's declining. I'll give a little more money to the ones who are participating.
Okay. Let's open it up to the phone then. Anyone on the phone who...
Presentation mode is now disabled.
Anyone on the phone with any comments or questions?
Hey, Mal, it's Scott Davis again.
Okay.
Three quick ones. First, on the hospitals that didn't provide enough claim level detail, I know ours are some of those. And I did check with our IT folks, but the ability to generate a new batch of claims that don't suppress the codes would require us to touch the accounts one by one to trigger a new claim and change the billing rules, which isn't very efficient. So I guess I would ask if you guys could look at perhaps a standard Excel template or something that we could fill in from our data set that you could add to your data?
We could, well, I'm not sure it'll help you, but yes, we can certainly come up with an Excel template. We already were planning to come up with a list of fields that we are hoping to receive, kind of some that we absolutely have to have and then some optionals. And the list is not going to be that long.
I tried generating a whole new batch of like 837 files to do that, but they said they'd have to touch every claim individually, and that kind of killed it.
Okay, that's okay. In all honesty, we don't want 837s. We don't have the software to try to interpret those anyway. So we're not expecting a full resubmission of claim data in that format. We're hoping for more of a one-off spreadsheet anyway. That would be easier for us to work with.
Okay, look forward to that. Second, on requiring CPT codes on all the line items, we would want to take a further look at the detail on that. I'm pretty sure that the general pharmacy 250, supplies in the 270s, maybe anesthesia, probably today don't even really need CPT codes and don't affect the EAPGs. But I just want to be sure we have a process in place for reviewing what those billing rules are before we have to say, we'll reject claims that don't have them on a line item.
Uh-huh.
Yep, okay, good point.
The third, where you say that the 340B impact is not material enough to leave drugs unbundled, I would argue as a 340B provider, it is material to us when a certain batch of those drugs that we currently bill with Revenue Code 250 are now not eligible for 340B. But some of that may be our own doing, and so one of my questions is whether or not there is a list someplace of which Level 2 HCPCS codes you're currently considering to be part of Revenue Code 636 and subject to separate payment, so we can make sure that our pharmacy system complies with that list.
Okay. I think maybe we can look at this or make some information available to you too. I think the answer to that particular question is going to be in the definitions manual for the EAPG software, which 3M creates. And actually, I meant to mention this anyway. We have talked to 3M about making that available to the hospital community here, and they have said their standard rule is they will make it available at no charge. With a small agreement signed by the hospital that says they promise not to sell the information or something like that, within 6 months of implementation. So they are, and so far, holding out, wanting to know that, in fact, the legislature does decide to move forward before they make it available. So, even if everything goes as planned and goes smoothly, it will be 2 or 3 more months, I think, before you'll be able to get access to those manuals.
All right. Thanks for the info.
Any other questions on the phone?
Hi, this is Brian Chase. I have a question regarding their revenue codes.
We'll probably have to buy the annual update.
I agree with the previous caller who said 710 is a recovery room. You wouldn't put a CPT code on a recovery room charge. That's going to create a big headache on our end because no other payer requires a HCPCS code or a CPT code on 710 or 370 for anesthesia, 271, 272. You guys would reconsider certain revenue codes would not need a CPT code.
Right.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, we will look into that and try to, maybe we can even publish the plan in advance. There's certainly 6 months between now and when we're planning to implement this to allow for some comment. It is not our intent to, on some of these very, very low cost things that, as Scott mentioned, are really going to be bundled and part of, be paid zero in the EAPG method anyway. To the extent we can predict what those are, it would be good to make them an exception to this rule of requiring procedure codes.
Okay, thank you.
It sounds like there's someone on the phone there that has it on mute. Could you please unmute that phone so we can hear? All right. It doesn't look like that's going to happen. Are there any more questions on the phone? All right. Thanks, guys. You're going back on mute here.
Presentation mode is now enabled.
All right, so I guess since we went through all the questions in the room and then on the line as well, and there are nothing else here, I'd like to thank everyone for coming to this meeting as well as all the previous meetings. So as I had said at the beginning, we will have that report that will be due on November 30th, and we will submit it to the Governor of the House and the Senate. Just so you guys know that after we do submit that, we will post it to our website so everyone can access that and review it. That will be at our same EAPG website. And look for that probably, maybe not on the 30th itself, but shortly after that we can get it posted. And so then we'll have that report out there. And if anyone has any questions in the meantime, after or before we post it or after we post it, feel free to reach out to us. You can reach out to myself, Tom Wallace, or anyone else on my staff, and then we can get back to you on any questions you may have. So with that, I will go ahead and close and adjourn this meeting. Thank you very much.